Welcome back, everybody, to the That's Criminal podcast. Before we get to it tonight, don't forget, anybody who likes, subscribes, and rates the TCP gets a free ebook. Hit me up, either DM on Instagram at That's Criminal Podcast, or email me, john@johnstampwriter.com, and I'll send you either Brother's Keeper, Shattered Circle, or Wraith of Sheltermount, depending on what you're into. Also, spoilers is coming to Audible. I just finished some last minute edits. The producer narrator, Chaz Mandala, has been amazing to work with. He is honestly so good at bringing Banks and Wilk and Thompson, DeGuello, and of course Bianca and Poppy to life. He nailed it. So look for that. Pre-orders probably in the next couple of weeks. Link will be in the show notes, and we'll probably release that next month sometime. Also, gotta give a big thanks to Jen and Sherry and Cassidy at Books at the Beach. This past weekend was a blast. Thank you to all of you guys who came and took a minute to let me know what you thought about That's Criminal and the books. You can't beat it when you get to spend a whole weekend talking books with people. It was a lot of fun. I would have to say, though, the best part for me was the law enforcement talk that I did on Thursday, on Writer's Day. We had a great group, and the conversation, to say the least, it was pretty wide-ranging. First question I got was, how would aliens affect how you conduct a crime scene? Yep, and I knew right at that moment that we were going to have a blast. And somehow, I did manage, for my forensics people out there, I did manage to put Locard's theory of exchange in the same sentence as aliens. I don't know if that's ever done before. I feel like I'm the one who reached that pinnacle. And if you know somebody else who managed to link aliens and theory of exchange principle, please let me know in the comments. And you can imagine where we went to from there. So a lot of fun. I can't wait to do the same law enforcement talk at Space Coast next June and back at the BATB in the fall of 23. So. Thanks again, Jen, Sherry, Cassidy, and everybody else down there this weekend in St. Pete's. It was a blast. All right. Tonight, I am excited to talk to you again, best-selling author of the Last Jewish Gangster trilogy, David Larson. Last time we talked to Dave, we covered the early years of Michael Hardy, godson of Bugsy Siegel, son of one of the most prolific female associates of the mob in history. Hardy's life literally is like a modern day Western, almost the mythical. Like I always think of Jason and the Argonauts when I think about this guy, just one adventure to the next, a little darker than Jason at times, but, you know, Jason was trying to steal too. So I don't know if we can do a moral judgment there. Just a quick summary. Hardy's, pretty much ignored by his mom. Mom's a problem. He has gangsters for role models growing up. And he decides one day to show mom how tough he is and takes on that life of crime. He's going to be a gangster through robberies, different heists, the drug trade, other rackets, anything he can come up with, right up until he and mom get nabbed in Mexico facilitating a stolen car ring that spanned from New York to California. Like a good son does, trying to get mom's love, he takes the rap and does mom's time in one of the most notorious prisons in the world, La Mesa, otherwise known as the Devil's Table in Tijuana, Mexico. So where that first book followed Hardy as a child up until the point where he and mom get caught, today we're going to talk about volume two, the Last Jewish Gangster series, The Middle Years. And book two picks up with Hardy going under the alias Richard Mandel as he's booked into La Mesa prison. And the story just keeps going, just as high speed as it was in the first one, bouncing from New York to Israel, California. After he gets out of La Mesa, this guy's story is like reading a Tarantino movie. So, Dave, welcome back to the TCP. And man, I love the second book just as much as I love the first one. You're amazed by this dude. You know,
I was. Thanks for having me, John. Yeah. Hardy's life was just when you understood what drove him. As he said, if he stood still, he'd die like a shark. He has to keep on swimming. And where he swam was in the dregs of society, doing hits for the mob, robbing drug dealers because he thought it was a little bit safer. Who were they to squeal to the mob, to the police? And cutting scams and trying to survive prison in Mexico to begin with. He was set to do 12 years initially, and he got out after a year. I just had to pay off the right people.
But yeah, and we pick up literally, we pick up with mom basically not even waving goodbye, just being like, all right, there's the guys doing my bit. I'm out. And she just takes back off to California. As I was reading it, she came to visit like once, right? It was always Uncle Morty coming to deliver money. She has no place in the picture, even though he's fighting for his life in this place.
She did not visit once, although she promised she would. She'd send money. I'm there for you, Michael. No, she just disappeared.
Yeah. And that's, you say what motive, you know, you just mentioned what motivates him, but this guy it was a tragedy. I mean, he spent his whole life trying to prove to mom, and she would toss him away in a heartbeat. She did several times. How many times did he go to jail for?
Twice.
Yeah.
Twice. Once for counterfeit money, another time to get time off of her sentence. She turned him in. And then the year she died, he hooked her up with a talk show. I think it was Maury Povich. They were interviewing gun malls. And he hooked her up for that. And they flew her back to New York. She got treated like a queen. And she came back and she complained about the food, you know?
Of course. Yeah. And we'll get to that point. He does land in Hollywood at some point. And I got it. I have questions on that one. but I guess we'll start with La Mesa. I mean, reading up on it, it's the devil's table. It is like we were talking earlier. It's just a savage place, but there's a weird, it's described as one of the most purest forms of capitalism in the world. I mean, if you can survive long enough, you can open a restaurant there. One of the guys there had a chop shop running out of in the prison. As long as you're paying off the commandante good enough, you can do whatever you want. It's fascinating. Paint a picture for that for us.
Well, Hardy came in there, doesn't know the language, doesn't know the customs. He befriends an NFL player, former NFL player that played for the New York Giants. And he starts hanging around with him. He's trying to play just a dumb white guy in the prison. There's about 25 Americans, about 800 Mexicans. And there are whole families that live in this prison. It's unlike, there are restaurants in there. Tuesday nights are girlfriends. Thursday nights, wives would come in. And Sundays, they would open the front gates to the prison and whole families come in along with taco carts and fruit carts. And they play a game and soccer and everything. You could own a gun. You could own a knife, but you could not use them to escape. If you did escape and didn't kill anyone escaping, your time would continue running while you're out of prison. If you had 2 years left in your sentence and you escaped, you're on the run for a year and they bring you back, you only had to do one more year. There was no penalty for escaping because they believed the nature of man was not to be confined.
I would have to say that would have to be the challenge. Like if you get in and the guy right after you take your first bribe, so you're not stuck in the corral, he says, hey, if you can get out, we're still going to run time. Just how fast are you? That night, I'm scaling that wall. but the gates were open. Like
Sundays. On yeah, Sundays, gates they were open. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whole families. They, Hardy, it all changed a couple months into his stay there when a big drug lord was arrested. And when they arrested and brought him in, this drug lord, Patricio Becerra Ortiz, they brought in his whole family. And his sister opened up a Mexican restaurant. And this drug lord started building these big plazas and little hotel rooms for other people they would pay. He had cement trucks coming in day and night, just building, and just paying off the commandante.
Yeah, the infrastructure improvement plan was amazing. Like he came in with an entourage and right behind him, the concrete trucks, they just start pouring new buildings. It's like, that's the way to do prison right there.
Well, Hardy met him after he killed a vulture, the guy that had stabbed seven people to death in a knife fight. Hardy put this guy away and Patricio saw him over by the infirmary, and he said, you're one tough mother. Okay. You want to come to work for me? And well, Hardy does. So Hardy goes to work for a gay drug lord
in 1968. This is 1968. Yeah. Not today.
In this Mexican prison. And, his job, Hardy's job, was to sell and collect money from the 25 Americans and to do anything else Patricio wanted to do. And Patricio started, he had this great big Holiday Inn super suite on the top of the prison so he could see Tijuana in the distance. He'd have parties Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night, hookers with mariachi bands, with all kinds of stuff. It was just unworldly.
Yep. And that guy did have a weird sense of rules to him, because he did, you know, he brings Hardy on, or Mandel at this time, yeah, as muscle, because he's shown what he can do, but he also puts him in the drug game to get him some money. But the strict rules are, you sell to Mexicans, I'm going to kill you. You keep the Americans high, we're good to go. Right. So there was a code in that place that rings through that part of the story that I found very interesting, very dirty, but very, there's a weird set of morals that ran that place but at the same time, like there's one scene where Hardy's wife at the time is having lunch with him. A guy comes in and just does a hit at the next table over, and just right in front of this woman who was there on wife's day, like Thursday. Just a savage, just absolutely savage place.
And she gets splattered with brains and everything. And, she's just so shook up, and Hardy takes her. She never visits him again. And a couple months later, he finally writes her the letter, you know, go on, find somebody else. He had no idea. There was no trial, by the way. They just shipped him into this prison. So there was no justice system or anything. He was gone.
And he had no idea. There was no plan either. The frustration of his lawyer was fascinating at times, because he'd come in and the lawyer would have nothing to tell him. Just no idea where your case is, no idea what stage we're at. And there was one little bit that I think finally got him some traction. I couldn't remember. Oh, it was his affidavit when he confessed. He had no idea what he was confessing to. It was all in Spanish. Stop hitting me, I'll sign it.
Yeah. Stop. Well, they chained him to a wall and were hitting him with 2x4s. And the comandante, well, this is wasn't in the prison, this is in the jail, would take a cattle prod to him. The commandant, he had called Hardy's mother a Jew whore, and Hardy spit in his face, and that's set off a string of punishments. So yeah, again, he's trying to impress his mother through all this.
Yeah, signing whatever that guy says. just don't hit me anymore. And mom gets to go home and forget about me.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a carnival atmosphere in that place. And the fact that he makes it a year, I mean, it's kind of he can strategize on the fly. And I imagine growing up in that life, you have to be able to read the room, but right from the beginning, you know, the payoffs and the bribes on his first day, he stretches $4 into pretty much building his own infrastructure, right? Yeah. I mean, after his payoffs, yeah.
He figures out how to make it work, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I will say,
he befriends the right guys. The Val, the former NFL player, he's in prison because he tried to run a huge it was running guns to Castro or something in Cuba.
Yeah.
And he gets busted for that. And this guy Val had a car dealership in Orange County that was doing real well, and that all went away.
Yeah. Just vanish in Tijuana. Yeah. Yep. And he's the guy that had to chop shop with the comandante in the prison. So, stealing from America, chop them up in Mexico, send them back to American parts in prison. It was great. Like at least the guys can learn a skill. Like, you don't have the $50 to beat the work detail, you can go learn how to be a mechanic.
Yeah, every morning it was really every morning they have a 7:30 roll call, Elista, and they would find out who was there, and then you pay 50 cents and not work for the day, go do whatever you wanted. So it was everything cost money. You want to take a shower in the crummy place, cost 10 cents. You want to take a shower in a good place, 25 cents. And they provide a towel and some soap. Yeah. The other one you had to worry about the scorpions and rattlesnakes.
Yep. Every single day costs every aspect of life costs money. And he starts with $4. I mean, luckily he had the family to back him up, but it wasn't mom. It was like Uncle Morty. Yeah. The guy seems to be the only stable part of his life for the most part. Him and maybe an aunt.
Yeah. Aunt Florence. Uncle Morty's 11 years older than him. And they shared a bed when they were younger, you know, as Michael never had his own bedroom or anything. And he was always a good influence, but not enough of an influence in his life. He would just come help bail him out. He'd get an ice cream truck. This happened in the first book, and let Michael drive the ice cream truck. He had a pet store he came into, where they sold the monkey over and over again because it was so crazy and fractious. The people that buy it just hand it back. So I don't want my money back. Just take the monkey.
Take the monkey.
So he included Hardy in a lot of his things, but nothing stuck.
Yeah. Like he tried, like, I remember from the first book, he brought him down to Florida to try and get him out. And Hardy just, what's he make it 2 weeks before he just is like, I wonder what's in that house. I'm going to go burglarize your neighbor. it's like the guy just keeps running into the wall over and over and over again with that guy.
That was the only time he left evidence behind. He left fingerprints on a Playboy magazine. All things.
He learned.
Yeah.
He learned. Yep. And yeah, so it's like, it starts out really just in that savage place where he embeds himself. You know, he stumbles into a Navy guy who came down to buy some dope and got swept up. And that was like, oh, it sucks for you, pal. But he didn't have nearly the resources that Hardy did. But that guy is able to lay out the plan. And then Val puts him into action. And then when Patrice showed up, that's like his meal ticket. And he just, but he knew how to play that position every step of the way.
And Patricio asked him to go do some hits for him. And a couple times he isn't the right time. You know, Patricio gave him a weapon, a .22, to go use to execute these people. And he finds an excuse not to. You know, he was just trying to juggle all these balls and try and stay out of the line of fire.
Yeah, just trying not to be a part of it because they got, I mean, just his size alone drew attention from several, and the fact he's American. All the things, all the different variables that he had to deal with that. It was like he was he was like surfing a wave like the entire time. And that was just the start of the book. I was wondering though, while you guys were working together, so he gets out of La Mesa after about a year and he makes a go at trying to be straight.
Yeah.
Was he just worn out or just burnt out or did he actually try to make up for lost time?
Well, he comes back and he sees his son that was born when he was in prison before in New Jersey and his daughter. And he goes, okay. And by the way, he tries to commit suicide.
Yep.
Right away. He's staying with his mom and she has a problem with him eating all her cottage cheese one morning after 3 days with her. And she slams the door and walks out and he's left alone, you know, with a damn it, go take a shower. And on his way to the shower, he goes to the closet instead and gets his 25 that Patricio gave him as a parting gift in Mexico. And he puts it to his chest, says a couple of goodbyes, pulls the trigger, click, breaks down the gun, puts it back together, makes sure there's a bullet in the chamber, no ceremony, click. Then he realizes the firing pin is all screwed up, you know, and enough self-pity, hell with it, go get a job.
Yeah, but the simple fact he actually tried to fix the malfunction to break down that weapon and do it again is, I mean, most of the time that first, whatever that intervening factor is, would give somebody a wake up. And he was on. The fact that he went back and kept doing it, like that was, like he was... He tried, but
so he worked construction under the table, getting $25 a week, which is okay back then. Mm-hmm. And he gets injured a couple months into the job, falls a couple floors on scaffolding. He's okay. He's 6'1", 280 most of his life, you know? And yeah, he shrugs it off. And the foreman says, oh, be careful, you know? And he calls up his uncle, and his uncle says, you've been hurt on the job? Well, not really. He says, wait, no, you've been hurt on the job.
Right.
Take him to the hospital. I'll have a lawyer come over. So he gets put on disability right away. And he doesn't have to work. And then he starts getting into other scams. Things start coming too easy.
Yeah. And like he could sniff an opportunity just at least in the book. He just like he's trying. Like he even seems like he was a security guard at one point and just stumbled on a box of money. It's like, come on.
He was working late at night men's clothing store. And he reaches up on the shelf in the storeroom. He sees his box of Argyle socks and he counts out over $12,000. He doesn't take it all. He's smart enough. He only takes half, fluffs it up. So the person coming in there who's feeding it doesn't realize. He gives half of it to his buddy, $3,000 to his buddy who set him up for the job and keeps $3,000 for himself. There's something smart about the things he does relationship wise with women. He's just all messed up with his mother. But some of the criminality stuff, Nick Pileggi, who wrote Wise Guy and Casino and co-wrote the screenplays for Goodfellas and Casino, knew Hardy for 35 years, said he's the most intelligent gangster he ever met. He just doesn't mean he was just so smart, but relationship wise, he was a mess.
Yeah. That example alone shows that impulse control that most career criminals just can't help. That's why they're criminals. It's not like they're out seeking fortune. They're just seeing an opportunity and chase it like a squirrel. But this guy, he's got that strategic control to not take it all. And how long is it going to take him to figure that out? But yeah, so that lack of impulse that he can master, I think serves him pretty well. But he just, that opportunity, like, right, he gets that disability and then just sees that I've got a paycheck coming in. Let's go see what we can do. And just escalates. And he goes from that to he starts impersonating a cop because he ordered a badge online. Not even online. Oh. No. It's mail. There's no online. It's mail,
this,
right?
This Schenectady. No. He went right into the store. Schenectady police supplies. And he ordered a badge. And he was wearing the uniform of security guard anyway. And after he hits this $3,000 that he kept and he gave to his friend, he's driving home and he sees this guy driving erratically, pulls him over. He said he was going to write the guy a ticket because he looks official. And the guy gives him $50 to let him go. And that was almost sweeter than the $3,000 he just got. And so he gets into his head, this idea of impersonating police officers and going busting drug dealers. And so he starts up doing that. Really lucrative.
Yeah. If it's that easy. Yeah. And it's just that kind of just seeing, my mind doesn't work that way, but it's just so funny. Your books show that, that criminal infrastructure that most people don't see, you know, on our surface day-to-day life, you know, commuting back and forth to work and, you know, Little League on the weekdays and all that good stuff. But they just have this infrastructure that is in place for them, like, you know, hitting those drug dealers, knowing where to find those drug dealers, just having all that community around him that he can just run ideas off us, find a buddy and just go knock on doors and start ripping people off. Population, you know, they're not going to tell anybody. Yeah.
And then he finds, and then when he finally does get busted for him, police are waiting. They go circled around and go hit a drug dealer. They hit one of the first ones they hit. Police are waiting for him. And they try to nail him for every single crime for robberies like that. They even put ads in the paper, the police did, looking for drug dealers they give them immunity to come in and say that they were robbed by him. Hardy, his cohort, this guy, Duke Seminary, goes away right away, cuts a deal, and he goes away to Sing Sing for 2.5 years. Hardy goes crazy in court, just nuts. he tells us, whispers to his lawyer ahead of time. I forget what the code was, but section something. And Clark's throwing papers in the air. They're going to kill me. Oh my God, the Nazis are everywhere, you know, and the judge is trying to calm everyone down. And his lawyer yells for, I forget the number. He calls and it's like the psychiatric evaluation. And the judge wraps his gavel, the prosecutions, and they throw Hardy into Bellevue Hospital in New York, undergo evaluation. And a former mafia guy that specializes in doing with bug outs, acting like you're crazy, teaches Hardy what to do. So they send him to the state mental hospital.
Nice.
And Hardy escapes from there, and he goes on the lam. He's always working something.
Yep. And to have that ability to, you know, got the infrastructure, get coached and just instinctively know how best to play the system because he's grown up in it. But the other thing that is such a departure from like our life is, yeah, I got these kids at home, but I got to disappear for about 6 months. And the family's like, yep, that's just I do what you do. And he just vanishes, you know, takes off wherever he needs to go, comes back around when needed, and just picks right up every time. He's just that's so alien to me and alien to somebody who's not in that world. But I don't understand how he's able to just disappear when he needs to, show back up, and everybody's like, oh, look who's home. You know,
well,
we get about 6 months.
Yeah. He ran off to Israel for a while. He had been arrested. He used an alias when he got arrested, but he knew they were going to find out it was Michael Hardy. I think he used Richard Mandel at the time. So he sold everything, his motorcycles and car, to a friend of his. He took off on July 4th, Icelandic Air, over to Europe, landed in Stuttgart, trying to figure out where to go, what to do. He has no plan. And he's watching all the tiles click in the train station there. And some guy next to him at a ticket booth mentions something about Tel Aviv. And he goes, ah, okay, give me a ticket to Tel Aviv.
Never been there before.
Yeah. So he shows up at Tel Aviv. He goes to immigration, you know. They put him to work on a kibbutz in olive groves right across the Jordan River.
Yeah, right in the middle of a shooting war, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and he does have that, you know, he's the, Jewish mother, Southern Baptist father, more or less type thing. So, but he's there, and he does make an effort to learn the culture and explore his roots a little bit.
I'd say he touches the hem of his heritage a little bit. You know, he's his trip into Jerusalem and the Wailing Wall and all that, it just was stunning to him. Just the history he was just surrounded by just blew him away. Yep, but not enough to change his life.
Which is funny to me. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, being in a place that's got that deep of history, like a couple thousand years old of humanity right there, that has a way of, you know, sinking into people. And it was, I mean, for as intelligent as he was, it just wasn't, whatever that was inside him wasn't enough. Cause I was actually surprised he managed to keep it together in Israel as long as he did, just because the opportunities were there, you know. And especially on something like a kibbutz, an enclosed, you know, tighter, smaller community, he had that discipline to not expose himself and run amok when opportunity knocked. I mean, it's just another one of those examples of his discipline, but it seemed like too such an easy atmosphere, and he didn't take advantage of it, which was another thing. The guy is just surprising when you read about him.
I think it goes back to working on the books. He was unsettled, you know, even though he wasn't really attached to his kids and his wife that much. He's out of touch with them, and that's his roots back in Brooklyn, and just unsettled. So he finally gives grief to some guy in the kibbutz, and they kick him out, and he's sleeping on the beach in the Tel Aviv, and ends up saving a Swiss girl who's drowning, and he's in the hospital for a while, and comes back to Brooklyn, you know, with half the Mediterranean in his lungs.
And that's another one of those examples, just randomly, he finally loses it, gets called out, and then happens to rescue, you know, save someone's life just because he fell on, because he passed out on the beach. It's another one of those just weird roller coaster parts of the guy's life that continues to just show up throughout the book. That's why it's like we're just going from one adventure to the other with the guy, and it's two volumes moving into three. And it's like, so we go through La Mesa, where he doesn't speak the language, manages to build his own business and become profitable, survives that, goes home, tries to go straight, slides back in when opportunity knocks, to the point he gets heat. Why not try Israel? You know, finds himself hanging out in Germany. I'm going to go to Israel now. Chases down that adventure, comes back, and you'd think at some point there's going to be aging out, or there's going to be enough heat with his intelligence. He's going to chill for a little bit, and he runs right back into the world. But the figures that, and I don't want to take away from you, but the figures he starts running into, like, I mean, he gets back from Israel. Is that when him and Sammy hook up and start working?
Yeah, he gets introduced to Sammy the Bull Gravano. Sammy and Alley Boy worked in a gang called the Rampers, and they were looking to step it up a little bit more. And Hardy was looking for some people that could do more heavy lifting, some deals where they would need to come in heavily armed. And so he worked, Sammy and Alley Boy Cuomo worked in his crew 23 different times, pulling different jobs. That was the same time when he took 14 contracts for the mob. Again, trying to get his mother to, hoping to hear from someone, you know, even the guy that was giving him the contract, hey, say hello to Shirley for me. Yeah. And Hardy's thinking, well, you say hello to her and tell her what I'm doing, you know?
Yeah, a little bit of credit. He's always looking for that, always looking for the affirmation that everybody around him scared of the guy, but and respects the guy, but not mom. And mom's the only one he cares about. And it's just it gets sad. I mean, he's not that old, but to be an established adult and still be chasing that, that's where that little slice of tragedy comes in that can make you just feel for the guy a little bit, even though he's doing horrible things. He's running rampage for like 30 years, and it's like that. But that sliver of just looking for some kind of approval is it's pretty sad.
Yeah, he wears wires for Giuliani to nab a dirty cop, really a dirty cop. This cop used to set him and Sammy up to kidnap drug lords in New York City for $1 million ransoms. He'd take a cut of that. I made the mistake of asking Hardy, what'd you do with your money? Because one year he cleared nearly $1 million and he really got upset. And almost like, don't ask me. Well, I knew he was being the big man on campus and walking into clubs and tipping $100 to bellmen and waitresses and everything like that. He did. But how do you go through $1 million like that? He never bought a home. Never bought a car, never did. He just, I know he was gracious sometimes when he got back to with his family during the holidays, but I don't know how you go through that much money. He didn't lose it. No one took it from him.
It's especially in the early 70s. I mean, was there ever any chance that he might have been forward thinking enough to stash something or was he just blew it? And we're in, what are we in, 73, 74 by the time we're having in the timeline here?
Yeah.
At $1 million in 1974, I mean, you could buy a car for like $1,500 back then, right? I mean, I don't understand, you know?
he, for whatever reason, he didn't. And then, you know, he sets up this cop, wears wires. And then the deal he has going with Giuliani is almost too good to be true. In fact, it makes him paranoid. So he bugs out on him. Oh, every single crime he's committed in the state of New York was going to be wiped clean except murder. And he was going to be walking. Even a judge he went before wouldn't even give him probation because he knew no probation office would even want to deal with this guy. So they got exonerated, but he thought it was too good to be true. He took off. And they arrested him, and Giuliani was so tired of him, he just threw him in prison. So he ends up going to Danbury, at least a federal prison, where, you know, you don't have gangs, things like that in there. And he went to Danbury prison where there were enough notorious mobsters in there where they were having concerts with you know, concert with Frank Sinatra would come in and sing. So life wasn't that hard. He took a couple classes, an acting class, and he took a German class because the wife, the woman that was teaching the German class, her husband wrote some book on the something about human sexuality, and the guy went to prison for it. So Hardy wanted to know about that. Then he found out she was just boring. Quit that. And he took a Bible class, and that's where he met this guy, Jud Tanner, who was high up in the Maritime Union, and became best of friends with him. And this guy mentored him, and he showed him there was a piece about this man. This guy's doing 3 years in prison there, and there's just a piece about it Hardy didn't get, and he wanted that for himself. And he they studied the Bible. They walked the yard every day. And when Hardy got out, Jud said, call me up anytime for anything. I'll send my Learjet. Well, it wasn't Learjet back then. Yeah, a private plane to pick you up.
Yeah, because what was his background? He had money. He was.
Oh, yeah. He was Maritime Union.
Yeah.
He was an executive. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Hardy called up New Year's. Jud was on furlough down in Florida, his home, and found out the guy died. And again, just he felt lost. And at the same time, there are a couple of U.S. marshals that had a halfway house and a hotel they were running. They were trying to scam him, charging him $5 a night not to sleep in his hotel. And Hardy wouldn't be scammed. So he calls up Giuliani again. He wears wires and busts those marshals. So he's trying to work within the system, and trying to eke out as much as he can everywhere he goes.
Yeah, but that moment when he's in prison again, like in Israel, making an attempt at culture, and it seems like an evolution, and then that one rock he's leaning on falls. Just like every time he tries to take a step forward, that it's the ground that falls out from underneath him like that. That's why I say the guy's life is a roller coaster. And so he falls from that and just stumbles into two more dirty cops and calls up his buddy Giuliani of all people and just goes again.
And then when he gets out of prison, then he's trying to get something else going on. And he calls up Sammy after Danbury prison, and Sammy won't give him the time of day. He's we'll do coffee sometime, you know. And Hardy gets so upset with that he calls up Giuliani again, and he signs an affidavit that Sammy the Bull said he murdered the Dunn brothers. It was unsolved murder. They've been after for a long time. And they put him in WITSEC, witness protection, and they fly him to California. And he's got a cheap little hotel on La Brea. And Hardy just starts working it because he gets paid $175 a week just to sit there and do nothing while they wait to see when he gets called back for a trial or hearing or something. And he goes to work, calls up an old friend of his that he had met before in early 60s, and goes to work at a small studio. B studio called Raleigh Studios, and the president of the studio loves him, and Hardy becomes his muscle. And Hardy thinks he's making movies.
Yeah. Well, and that's where when I was reading it, all I could think of is Get Shorty. And it was, is there a possibility that he's the impetus behind Get Shorty? I read the book years ago, M.R. Leonard's book, so long ago. Never really cared that much for the movie, but that's all I can think of is did you ever see that?
Yeah.
One?
Oh yeah.
Read the book.
Yeah.
Yeah. So did he ever mention that he was the guy behind Get Shorty or anything like
that? No, that was a whole Miami connection. So it was a different part of the mob connection.
Okay.
But yeah. But the actual guy, Chili Palmer, had a small bit part in the movie.
And
so it was his story. So yeah. Hardy goes to work for the big muscle for the guy to keep investors off his, somebody give him $500,000 and he wasn't making the movie, he promised. So Hardy kind of made up what to tell the guy to get him off his back. That relationship with Raleigh Studios will end up costing him nearly his life. He shot six times. This happens in book three. Shot six times in a gunfight at Raleigh Studios. And everybody hears the guns going off and they think it's part of a movie. They're looking for cameras. Yeah. He drives himself to Cedars-Sinai Hospital where he flatlines.
Wow.
And yeah, just Raleigh Studios comes in and out of his life for 10 years.
And it's out of all the places, out of all the things that he's done, the thing that almost gets him is playing make believe in LA. That's like, come on, like just just follows back to the like the guy's either got a charmed life, a disaster, or you know he's just riding chaos. Like he's just chaos for his entire life. So when he comes into these famous characters, you know, Sammy the Bull, Rudy Giuliani, ends up working in Hollywood. It's hard to believe while you're reading that this is a dude's biography. Honestly, there's many times where I'm just like, come on, man. Like, you know, when you mentioned that, that he, you know, barked at you a little bit about talking money, how was the relationship with you guys? Cause I think we talked about last time it was Pileggi that got you guys together. And we talked a little bit about the feeling out process, but as far as the collaboration, what was the chemistry like?
I felt like I had to take a shower every time I met with him for the first couple months. Cause it was just, plus he was just spewing so much. He was just so anxious to tell somebody his story that he just kept on dumping about what he did and he whacked this guy and robbed this person. I stuck this gun. You know what a buckwheat is? I said, no. Oh, it's when you stick a gun up somebody's ass and you pull the trigger. Oh, I didn't need to know that, but
okay.
Yeah. Who did you do that? He did this to Henry Kodelsky, a guy that wouldn't take his mother's call from prison. So he decided he was going to kill him, torture him. He was just so enraged. So I realized I was working with a youth group here in San Diego that started in San Diego called Boys to Men, not the singing group, but Boys to Men. And their mantra is listen, accept, and encourage. And so I started using that with him. Don't challenge him. Just listen, accept, and encourage. I take my notes. I go back and double check a lot of these things. It was raining the day this happened. Oh, really? Yeah, I took my notes. You can find out the weather, you know, 1972 in Danbury, Connecticut. Oh, it was raining that day. You know, just even simple things like that by the weather and some of his contacts he had. So I learned not to challenge him because then he'd shut down. If I couldn't ask too much detail, because he'd get off track. He'd get, no, I want to tell you about this incident. He didn't want to stop and tell me the guy was wearing white shoes and a white belt.
Yeah.
I put that in the copy that I would write. And then he'd tell me afterwards when we review it. No, that wasn't right. He was wearing this, this, and this. Oh, okay. So that's how I get that level of detail. But I'd put it in there to fill it in, just edit it later.
So it kind of sounds like he was, you know, once he had you, he's again just trying to look for that validation, that you just looking to impress somebody, just get that kind of, you know, awe from one person in his life. His mom's gone by now, so he's got that hole in him. Like sounds like one of those dudes at a party that wants to immediately, instead of like starting out slow, just immediately goes into the brag. You know.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
it was fascinating what I wrote about 8 chapters of the book, and he suggested we get in touch with Jimmy Blatt, the lawyer that defended him in 1991 and cut the deal where he went away for 11 years for second-degree murder at halftime. Hardy wasn't the ideal prisoner, so he got a couple more years. And he defended him in 1998 after Hardy got out. Jimmy Blatt defended him again for helping a prisoner murderer, David Finney, escape a prison here in San Diego. Hardy did that to piss off the warden, because the warden planted some drugs in his cell. So he was pissed off and he was going to get even with him. And the warden said, what are you going to do? Hardy said, you just wait. So the day John Ratelle, the warden, was flying up to Sacramento to be named the head of the Department of Corrections for the state of California, David Finney, a lifer, walks out of Donovan State Prison. And Hardy gets out of prison a few months later, and somebody inside rats on him to cut their time. And he was a part of helping this guy escape. So he ends up doing time for that.
But he does it out of a weird sense of justice. I don't, you know, with exploits of a life like that, I don't get it. But he's always got this weird sense of justice about him.
Yeah. Well, you know, this guy tried to take advantage of him. No, he's not going to let anybody do that to him. You know,
yeah, it's same thing. Sammy's not going to have coffee with me. All right, I'm going to call Rudy. Rudy will take care of you.
It works somehow.
He always stumbled into it. I don't get it. I don't get how he pulled that off. So this volume two. So my barometer for this was, at one point he says that he was 7 years out of the army, because I know he went into the army, wrote a letter to President Kennedy, got out of the army, out of all people. And so I want to say that this goes from like mid-20s to really early 30s. Like, there's so much built into this book, but it's not a huge span of time, right?
No, it's about 6 years, 6-7 years. That's it. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. He was in, when he was in Mexican prison, he managed to get a nice Caraca, like a hotel suite. He was watching the news and hears stories of Vietnam, and he's watching the news and going, I could have been that guy. I could have been wasting these gooks, you know, when he joined the army in the early 60s, he was just looking for this outlet. He had so much anger. He figured he'd kill Nazis or commies because they just put up the Berlin Wall. He joined the army. He's going to be a paratrooper. And then when he realized, a couple months into basic training, that Kennedy was a pussy, you know, he said, okay, we aren't going to go to war. Okay, that pisses me off. Now I'll go to war with the army. So they court-martial him, and then he writes a letter to Kennedy. It says, I'm being mistreated as a Jew. he draws the Jew card, which is really funny.
Yeah, and they, with the Catholic president.
Yes. Well, he breaks the chain of command, which is not not supposed to do. Yeah, he was a little bit removed from the president, commander in chief. So they a colonel comes to see him and lets him go.
Wasn't he one of those dudes who got the airborne tattoo before actually making it to jump school, though?
No, he went and got his eagle tattoo after he got out. It's just a symbol of pride. Like, I tried. Like, was
in, oh, okay. Yeah, but and then, still.
And then a year later, he goes down to, on his honeymoon, he goes down to the Pentagon. He makes an appointment and goes in front of him to try and get rid of his dishonorable discharge. And these guys kind of laugh him out of the room. You broke the chain of command. What are you thinking? So he's just his life trying to rectify something he had done, you know, just didn't work out for him.
Yeah, that level of narcissism is really impressive. You know, ultimately it's his idea. He decided that he was not going to be in the army anymore, and he didn't care how he got out. But it it doesn't look good right now. So these guys, I'm sure they'll understand. Let's just go drive to the Pentagon. We'll work it out.
Yeah, I'll impress these generals and these admirals. Yeah. They'll come around to my way of thinking.
Yeah, they'll get it. Yeah, swing and a miss. Yep. So in that 6-7 years, we start in La Mesa. We go back to New York. He goes to jail in Danbury, Connecticut. Oh, wait, nope. La Mesa, New York, Israel, Danbury Correctional Facility, California. While in between there, he hangs out with Rudy Giuliani and Sammy the Bull and then pits them all together against each other, gets bored with that, goes to Hollywood and decides to make movies and comes with an inch of his life getting shot on a movie set.
Oh, yeah.
Come on, guys. So
he meets his wife, the woman he kills at the beginning of the first book that he's arrested for. He meets her. She's a hooker down in San Diego, and she manages to steal all his mother's lilac crystal while she's in prison. And Lester, the gnome that takes care of her home while he's gone, gets Hardy to come down, and he squeezes this girl, and she's compliant. And he just, I'm going to bring you with me and you're going to work it off. So he drags her to Hollywood with him, and, you know, they get married a few years later because he doesn't want her to be able to testify against him. They end up having a child in 1978. This is the third book. And he ends up killing her in 1985. And his son helps him bury the body in the back of their yard.
Yeah, that was mentioned in the first book. That's just sinister. That's just amazing. Amazing how that could even be that kind of family unit could even be created. To talk about the
She tried to shoot him.
I remember that from the first
and book. Missed. Yeah.
But it's like, I don't, it's like, hey, Dad, can I help you bury the body? You know, let's
just hold this kid. Yeah. In 1990, Hardy's mother dies July 4th, 1990. A couple months later, his son, Robert, is in Corcoran Prison near Fresno. And he meets a pretty girl in the reception area. And he wants to get out early. So he gets the authorities to come in. He says, hey, I can tell you where a body's buried. And he helps draw a map, and then they pat him on the back and thank him because he's basically an accessory to either murder or covering up or helping bury a body. And they arrest Hardy, and that's how the first book starts. But the son wanted to get time off prison. Even his son turned him in.
Yeah. Well, it's runs in a family.
Yeah. They're good at it.
Yeah. That's whatever works in that time. So what was it that happened in Hollywood that he ended up in, you know, losing a, you know, out of all the things he's done, it's in Hollywood working in the movies that gets him shot up. What was the circumstances to that? Was it a money thing?
Well, this is in the third book.
Oh, it's third. Yeah.
But he, when he's working for the president of the company, there's someone been trying to angle his way in and get a studio spot. Guy by the name of Richard Skaggs. He ends up being a high up politician in the Republican Party, but he tries to commandeer a production office, and the president says, "Hey, get rid of this guy." And Hardy did it once. He, you know, with good great success, kicked him out. And then when he goes to do it a second time, this guy tries to pull a gun on him, and Hardy whacks him in the head with his gun on the top of his head, but the gun goes off and he creases his scalp, blood pouring out, and tells him, well, you can leave here in 10 minutes. Hardy goes back to his car, and the guy comes staggering out with a 45. It's just starts bullets flying everywhere. Hardy gets hit 6 times, drives himself to the hospital. Yeah.
In the movie business.
Oh yeah.
After everything else, it's just so hard to fathom. I needed to know the details of how that went about.
And his wife and 5-month-old baby and 12-year-old daughter in the car that are being shot up at the same time. So he jumps out of the car to get them shooting away from him, you know, manages to squeeze off. He's got this little 25. He's really he's really pissed off. He has some better guns in the trunk. All he can do is plunk this guy in the thigh beside the one on the scalp, and he gets shot up a bunch. He wow. spends a year in prison for it is all. This is just remarkable how this works out. Something about Richard Skaggs' gun, the 45 he has, is never brought into evidence. He doesn't want to press charges. All this stuff disappears after a year, and he's let out of prison.
Wow! But he is Michael Hardy, so they're going to keep him as long as possible, even though that talk about nine lives. I mean, it really comes down to nine. I mean, the dude skates on just everything.
You remember the Hillside Strangler up in L.A. Hardy mm-hmm. stuck in L.A. County prison with him, and his wife comes to visit him, and she's sitting across from him talking, the little steel corded phones that they have, and and sitting next to him is Angela Bona, and he's on the phone, but there's no one across from him. The wife's going, his wife that's a hooker, right? Yeah. And he's going, what's going on? Oh, that's Angela Bona. Oh, it is? And she was a hooker, and Angela Bona killed hookers. So she goes over to the little cubby hole next door and hops on the phone. It just lays waste to Angela Bona. UMF, she cusses him out. They kick her out of the place. Bona puts a hit out on Hardy. They try to throw some accelerant into his burn him up in his cell, but that screws up. Doesn't go right. So later on Hardy has a chance where he tells these guards he's going to be nice. He's going to the law library, which is right across from his cell, and he's doing a lot of work in there. And when they go to bring him back, it's July 4th, and he says, I'll be good. You don't need to put me on the chain. Oh, okay. And there's Angela Bona outside his cell playing checkers with someone, and he throws, he's huge. Throws these two guards aside, and he goes running over and dives it and starts strangling the Hillside Strangler.
And of course he did. Of course. Why? I would expect nothing else than this guy to run into a famous serial killer and just try to take him out after his wife yells at him. Yeah.
Yeah.
It fits the story. Actually, the story, if that wasn't in there, I would have been disappointed. I mean, I don't know if he ever met Elvis or anybody, but that'd be cool.
He rubbed elbows with some pretty interesting actors and characters. Stuart Whitman was in a movie about Murder Incorporated. And back in the early 60s, the mob set him up to show Stuart Whitman around Brooklyn before the movie was made. So he got to know some people along the way. And then when he started robbing drug dealers in Hollywood, all the cocaine and the money opened up all kinds of parties that he went to.
The all the people that he runs across and all the different events he's near gets to be like, he'd be the guy standing in the background during the Kennedy assassination. Right.
It's like Forrest Gump.
It's got a Forrest Gump vibe to it. Like he's just there at all these famous people from history, and just he was there. Oh yeah, I was there for that. Like that's what it feels like. Your interviews were like, what about the moon landing? Yeah, that was me.
I was in the capsule with them.
Exactly. They wouldn't let me out, but man, that I don't know. I was that that book was like the first one. There's so much packed in a relatively short period of time. It's like that, like you said, like the guy is a braggart, so you gotta just let him go. But then the vetting process, like at some point were you in this vetting process making sure you corroborate what he's saying? Is like, oh my god, yeah, he took down Sammy the Bull the first time, and yep, and Giuliani took his call. At some point were you just like, there's no way possible that he strangled the Hillside Strangler? Like, no, he did.
Yeah, there was an article about it. Hardy was in three movies when he was in Hollywood, two of them for non-speaking roles. They were one was called Fairy Tales, another one was called End of the World, and another one called Auditions, where he played a guy called Vinny Moluccio. And that's the only speaking one where he got to play a gangster that was interviewing for auditions for a porno movie. It was soft porn. All these movies were kind of like soft porn. They were done on the studio lot where he usually plays security that say, hey, we need somebody to be a gladiator or something. And he's just standing in the background wearing, you know, leather on his wrists and boots and stuff like that.
Hey, as long as he gets him a SAG card. Oh man, that's just funny. I honestly can't wait for part three. Where do we leave off and volume two and pick up in volume three?
Well, volume two ends up with him robbing his first drug dealer with his wife. She finds him, she sets him up, and he goes to this guy's place in the San Fernando Valley. And the last thing he does after he duct tapes him and he whispers in his ear, you know, from one pirate to another. The guy's wearing a little earring, you know, said, this is your cost for doing business on the high seas with me.
And his
lawyer, because every five chapters or so, he breaks away with his lawyer because Hardy's being on the prosecution team as Marcia Clark. And she wants it all. She doesn't want this second degree murder, anything that she wants first degree murder with a special circumstance of depraved indifference. And she wants just to crucify him. So his lawyer and Hardy are meeting every couple of weeks and they're trying to strategize. The lawyer brings up some of that while Hardy is telling him his whole story.
Wow. Yeah, that's that. There's another one. Like there's Marcia Clark hanging out with Marcia Clark, you know, like he was the 13th juror in the OJ trial.
Forrest Gump, I tell you.
Yeah, that's exactly that's what it feels like. I can't wait till part three. We've been going about an hour, and so I don't want to keep you all night. But like, I mean, just like the first time you're on, like this guy doesn't get you can't run out of material talking about this guy. It's just amazing, and it was funny. You dropped me that email telling me that part two's coming out. I was like, absolutely. This guy, that guy's a riot just to hear about. So yeah, no, I love the book. The book starts out so quick and there's so much going on. It's one of those ones. Like I start it at night. I'm like, a couple pages before I go to bed. And like 2 hours later, it's like, tomorrow's shot. I'll just keep going.
Well, he was the gift that kept on giving. He was, I mean, I knew him at the point in his life when he would go across the street, his electric wheelchair over to the Chicken Pie Shop, a restaurant that's been in San Diego forever on El Cajon Boulevard. And he finally got banned from that place. He was stealing salt shakers, but he was also trying to shake them down. He'd bring a chicken bone with him and he cough it out on his plate, and he'd try and get free meals and a pie and stuff like that. And they finally caught on to him. Someone at a noon shift had seen what he was pulling, the same thing in the evening shift. And they banned him from that place. So he even tried to keep on doing things like that later in his life, just try and make ends meet. You know, he got $600 and some in SSI he got every month. How do you live on that?
Yeah, but and like we said earlier, I mean, you clear $1 million in 1972 and it's gone. It's amazing, you know.
One of Hardy's stepfathers, Davy Goldberg, had told him, set aside 20% for legal. Just always set aside 20%. Hardy's young. Yeah. Sure. Never did.
Yeah. I've been there. I think that's the first thing you've said that I can relate to Michael Hardy about, but I'm pretty sure I was that dumb in my 20s too.
Yeah.
With money. Yeah. Yeah. But Dave, I appreciate it. When you get ready for book three, hit me up. I want to talk more. So
will do. This is always fun, John.
Absolutely. And good luck in Wild Blue, your publisher, my publisher, Amazon, pretty much anywhere books are sold. Is Audible out yet, or is that a couple months down the road?
Yes, is it? Yeah, Audible's out for both part one and part two. Michael, Last Jewish Gangster, the early years, and The Last Jewish Gangster, the middle years.
Awesome. And socials, Facebook, IG, any preferred method?
There's some stuff there. People can go to thelastjewishgangster.com and find out a little bit more information. Some picture of the family, some little background there. Yeah.
Excellent. And I'll make sure that those links are in the show notes. But Dave, I appreciate you reaching out. I can't wait to hear about the next one. Give me a call anytime, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Nice talking.
Bye-bye. See you, man.